So, it's nice to see so many people. How wonderful. And I want to thank again the people that ran the summer program. Elise organized it. Thank you so much. It was really great. And Muffy coordinated things. And Janet and, everybody.
Megan
took seats as the umze and whatever. So.
And weekend retreats.
I saw it all.
Fabulous.
No, it was really remarkable through the heat of the summer. Actually, that it carried, people carried on. So, amazing. We are starting with this book called "Living Beautifully with Uncertainty and Change" by Pema Chodron, and many of you probably have heard of Pema. She is a Western person who became a Tibetan Buddhist nun and is one person that I think really has been able to take very traditional Tibetan teachings and bring them into a Western vernacular, the Western world. And with this book, I feel she's gone even deeper. Instead of just giving us lists of things, there's the deeper aspect of everything that she's presenting, and also instructions and actual ways of working with the material. So my sincere hope is that people will work with this material in a way that goes beyond concept, that goes into feeling and how things feel in their body, in their heart, and that the teachings will come alive on a different level for people, because we're actually not just studying words, but we're actually working with the living Dharma. And it's going to be, everyone is going to have a different experience. So the way this module is structured is that we'll be doing there are three main points. You'll see three main commitments. And in the beginning of each one of those, there'll be more of a talk by one of the teachers. Then there'll be time, over two more times, to work with the material and bring in your personal experiences. So I would encourage you to get a notebook, and as you work with the chapters and the exercises, you actually write down your thoughts and go through a process. It's really up to each of us to go through the inner work of this material. As I said, it's not just concept. So what will make this class come alive is your own contribution of what you're discovering. And I believe it's a real path of discovery to work with these teachings that she's presenting.
Emily?
Yes.
I think it is important to have the book. And can you comment on how people can get it?
Amazon works. I would try there. And it's in Kindle version and also in paperback. So it's easy to get. And there is actually a CD set that Kathleen got from the library. So you might want to look for it. Yes, there it is. And it has a different name. What is the name?
Fully Alive. Fully Pema Chodron.
Right.
And it's quite different in many ways.
Well,
it's retreat that Pema did around this
right.
book.
Right.
But it's not the
not,
book.
It's not reading the book. It's a retreat based on the book.
Right.
And I got this from the public library, so it's in the system.
Right.
And I downloaded it, and a couple of other people did, and so I passed it on to Elise. I think it's due the end of the week, so maybe if Elise turns it in.
Like this Saturday? Maybe?
I think it might be due Saturday this week. So if Elise wants to download it, if anybody wants to borrow it from Elise, and then it's due. But I download it. It's interesting to listen to. I think it's four CDs.
Okay, great. So that's available if
so
you want to hear her
voice. So that's also available
at
the library.
Yeah.
You know, there's probably more copies in the system also.
Okay.
It don't even be on the system.
So these teachings, as you mentioned, were given at Gampo Abbey. and that's a monastery in Nova Scotia. And I think it's helpful to sort of set the visual view, because I did live there for actually a total of four years, because 1 year I lived at the monastery, and 3 other years I did a retreat with other people separate from the monastery. But when she talks about uncertainty and change, basically when she gives these talks, she's sitting in what used to be a barn, but it's on the upper floor, and there are windows in the front, and you're looking out these windows at the St. Lawrence, basically the Gulf of St. Lawrence. So it's the place where the St. Lawrence River flows into the ocean. It's a very powerful spot, and you're up high because it's a high cliff, and you can watch the eagles go by practically at eye level when you're sitting there. And this retreat is called Yarne, and it's modeled after what happened in India when the Buddha was alive. That in the rainy season, the monsoon season, the monastics didn't go out begging because they would step in puddles and they would kill insects. So they would have retreats during that time. And at Gampo Abbey, they tried that one summer, and the tourists kept knocking on the door because it's a nice place to go, way out in the wilderness there of Cape Breton Island. So they moved the retreat to the winter, which was a natural time to actually close in. So it's 49 days, and Pema goes there every year and does a series of talks on some particular topic that she feels she's ready to expound on. So that's what happened in 2009. She gave these talks, and then it takes several years for a book to emerge from that. So I think it's helpful to know that environment then is very intense. The boundaries are closed. You can't leave. No people can come. And it's a very strict setup in terms of your practice situation. So a lot of silence and, you know, very, very strict boundaries. So that's the environment where this teaching happened. So what I think, again, is amazing, she's taken what are traditionally called the three vows, which are very traditional Buddhist teachings, and translated them into the three commitments and made them applicable in our everyday life as humans in the West and having a different lifestyle from a monastic lifestyle. So I guess my notes are a little different from yours. So what I did was write out some of the main points that I'll be talking about. So as I said, this book is about the three vows. And I'll start with just what the traditional vows are, so you have a basis for understanding what then she presents as a more modern, you could say, interpretation. So the three vows, the first one is the Pratimoksha vow, and that's a Sanskrit word that means individual liberation. And in Tibetan, it's Soso Tarpa. Not that you have to know this, but I think it's interesting to just know the roots of these things. And it's based on the five precepts. The monastics had many more vows, like I think the men had 249 or something, and the women had 330. That always irritated me. But I guess that's one of the points I'll have to work on. And the five precepts, they're written out more in detail, and you'll read more in detail in the book. But this is the summary. No killing, no stealing, no harmful sexual activity, no lying, no alcohol or drugs. So that's the first basic vow and the environment of that. The second vow is called the Bodhisattva vow. And the Bodhisattva means awakened heart-mind being. So it's a person who basically vows to work with compassion in the world and vows to work with other people and help other people. The third vow is called the Samaya vow, and That means sacred word in Tibetan. It's Damsik, sacred word. And that means very simply to be open to all situations so that whatever occurs, there's potential for that to be a situation where we wake up rather than where we shut down and turn away. So it's quite extreme, you could say, in terms of living in the world in such an open way. So again, in another way of saying it, the first vow is more about working on yourself. This idea of individual liberation is, I was going to put it in the notes, but I didn't, get your own shit together, basically. It's really you work on your own path and your own ways of reacting in situations that might be harmful and not helpful. The second vow is about working compassionately with others. And the third vow is about seeing the whole world as sacred. So I just put it in a little different terms. So in this book, they are actually presented as the three commitments. And of course, we're going to go into those in more detail in each one of these different sections in the classes. The first one, Pema calls committing to not cause harm. The second is committing to take care of one another. And the third is committing to embrace the world just as it is. So again, we have done teachings in what's called the Hinayana, which is the path of individual liberation, the Mahayana, Maha means great, and Yana means path. The Mahayana is the greater vehicle, and that's the path of working with others with compassionate activity. And the Vajrayana is the indestructible path and the way of seeing the world totally as sacred. So it's interesting that when you learn about these three levels, you could say, or these three ways of working in the world, you start to see ways they actually appear in the world. And I might need some help on this, but the Unitarians, we say this covenant, and how does it go, Elise?
Well, this is the spirit of this church and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another.
So to dwell together in peace, that's like the first one here. Basically, not causing harm and being in good relationship with people. The second one is to seek the truth in love, which in a way is more like the third one here in this case, because when we talk about the Samaya vow or sacred word, sacred seeing everything is sacred, that is seeking the truth. You're really looking for the root or the path to awakening, to a deep understanding. And the third one is to help one another, which is the Mahayana vow. So there we are with the Unitarians. We have a couple people from this church that come to this. Well, now we got a bigger group. So I thought that was interesting. That just occurred to me. So in a way, when you start learning about some of these concepts, these views, you can start seeing them manifest in the wider world. So that's just a clue to see if you can find it yourself in other things that you participate in or other maybe religious groups you go to or whatever. So one way I think about teaching on the Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana is this more visual, and I've mentioned this before, but I think it's helpful, that going from the Hinayana, which is the narrow path, the path of self-liberation, you're working on your own thing, to the Mahayana, which is bigger and wider. It's the wider path to the Vajrayana, which is seeing from a vast view. I think it's helpful to visualize a mountain, and being at the base of the mountain, you could say, from the Hinayana point of view, you're on the ground. It's very much a grounded world, a grounded practice. You're working with what's really happening in your daily life and all the time. And then if you're going around that mountain and you get up a little higher, you're looking out, you could say, over the village, and you see people and they're going about their affairs and going to market or whatever. So you're a little higher and you see this view that's a little vaster, but it's very involved with other people in their world. And if you go to the top of the mountain, you're looking out over a vast expanse and you're looking at the clear blue sky. So the path is very open and spacious, and the view is quite vast. For me, that's a helpful way in terms of an image to think about that. As we work with these vows more, you'll have more pieces to put together that, you know, make more sense. Are there any questions up to this point? Any comments?
No? Any questions? Emily, it's almost like I'm thinking the view also is sort of like the first level, you're sort of just looking down.
Yeah.
Like looking at your, like when you're walking on a path, sometimes you just look at your feet.
Right, right.
Because you're like so not sure. And then you feel a little more sure, so you look around a little bit, but you're still sort of looking at what's happening right here.
Uh-huh.
And it's only when you feel really safe that you sort of look out,
mm-hmm.
and you don't feel like I have to be what's happening right in front of me now.
Right.
Who's moving, who's not moving? Like, that's not the problem.
Right. Yeah, you can take a bigger view.
Well, not, more. You know, it's sort of like this.
Uh-huh. That's true. Right. Well, it's interesting, too, even with our meditation technique, it mirrors that in a way. We start with a gaze that's lowered in our tradition, that the gaze is lowered about 6 feet in front or so, and there's a sense of stability that comes from not being so distracted by what's around. So you have a more grounded feeling. And then there are other practices where you raise the gaze more and look out. And so there's a variety of levels of what you do with your eyes. And sky gazing. Right. I think Megan did something with that, right? During the summer retreats. Yeah. So I think it's helpful to have categories. And it's not that we're trying to shoehorn everything into these categories, but it's a way to... It's a view, so it's a view. And, you know, you take what's useful and leave the rest. So, let's see. So, oh yeah, I typed this on here too. The gift, yes, yeah. Oh, sorry.
Just a quick question, maybe a quick answer. How do these three vows relate to refuge vows?
Uh-huh. Refuge would be in the first one, then in the Hinayana.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, the refuge isn't a pratimoksha vow,
mm-hmm.
which is more...
Is that for the monastics?
Yes, but lay practitioners can take the first five.
Okay.
And their modification of those. If you're married, for instance, it's a allegiance to your partner or whatever.
It's important to have harmful sexual activity.
Yeah. Erica, you're full of it.
Great pleasure.
Too funny. So, so the refuge vow, yes. Take refuge in the Buddha,
mm-hmm.
take refuge in the Dharma, take refuge in the Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
That's more of the Hinayana level. And the Bodhisattva vow is obviously the Mahayana level. We use that word also right here. Any other thoughts, questions? So I guess I did write this on your paper too. So this I feel this book is quite a gift from Pema because her particular way of working with teachings, not just, oh, well, it's just this or this list, and I just say it over again to everyone. But she takes things and really chews on them and thinks about it and applies them to her life. And I think that's what makes her teachings come alive. And you'll see her talking about her own experiences there, which is really helpful. So she was married. She has children. I think she was married twice. Different books she describes, you know, breakup of relationships and things. So she's really seen a lot in her world and can relate to everything that, you know, we experience too. So, let's go on. Yes.
Does a Tibetan nun need to be not married?
Yes, in this tradition, the nuns are not married, and that's in our tradition. Is that true?
Is that what you asked?
So along with that, they're celibate, right?
Yes. Supposedly. And then there's celibate, she said. There's celibate, yeah. And also, there are different Tibetan Buddhist traditions. I mean, there's the monastic tradition, and then within that, there's also the Dzogchen Vajrayana tradition where those teachers are married. So they aren't monastic. And that was the thing with Gampo Abbey. They had to have a monastic as the head of the abbey, which is Trangu Rinpoche. He lives in India. He's quite old right now. But he is a monastic. There's different...
So she's not?
She is a monastic, and she's celibate, yes. But she wasn't first. I mean, before she became a monastic, she had another wife.
She's not selling it here.
No. She's not selling monasticism. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so let's get to the heart of it here. Chapter 1 is the fundamental ambiguity of being human. So let's talk about what that fundamental human predicament actually is. And she calls it the moral ambiguity of the human dilemma. It's pretty amazing, huh? Does anyone have a comment on that that may have read what this material is in terms of what this predicament or dilemma is that she presents? Basically, she talks about how we're always trying to solidify our world and get ground under our feet. But in reality, there's no way to do that because everything is constantly changing. Everything is shifting and changing all the time. So within our life, we're trying to get it all together. Like, you know, you want the perfect situation, the perfect relationship, the right job, the right, you know, whatever, religion, the right situation for everything. We're always trying to solidify or hope for, or what if I only had more money or this or... But in fact, what she says is you can never get it together. You can never get it together. And I think this is something you should write in your journal and really contemplate. Have I ever been able to get it all together? You know, in other words, are you ever satisfied? And fundamentally, that is the first noble truth that the Buddha taught. He taught that life is suffering, and this suffering is this total dissatisfaction all the time. And even when we strive for some level of happiness, then it changes. Whatever we get is definitely going to leave. And fundamentally, we know that we're all going to die. I had to slip that in because nobody wanted A Course in Death. I'm priming the pump here.
Family. Yes. The line on that first page I liked was, how can we live wholeheartedly in the face of impermanence, knowing that one day we're going to die?
Yes.
Like she says it right there. Like,
yes.
Yeah,
which hit me.
Read it again.
How can we live wholeheartedly in the face of impermanence, knowing that one day we're going to die?
Right.
So it's sort of like, how do you like know that like whatever you're doing, it's going to be, you know, like even if you create all this wonderful stuff, at some point you're gone.
Right. Right.
Like, yeah. You know.
Right.
You could build a beautiful house and it's not going with you.
No, that's right.
You could weigh the perfect amount and then you die.
And so the grasping is, we're always grasping for something, you know? We're always trying to solidify. And she really does go into this a lot more. Oh, I think I put down here. She really talks about what does it feel like to be in this shifting state, this constantly shifting, groundless state, and how do we find some level of peace or relaxation within that. So she says that the root of our suffering is resistance to the fundamental uncertainty of our situation. Resisting change is suffering. Embracing change is enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Or she also calls it freedom. Embracing change is freedom. Freedom from struggling against the fundamental ambiguity of being human. And the root of this struggle is a fixed identity. And another way to say that is ego clinging. The root of suffering is not being able to tolerate uncertainty, constantly wanting things to be a certain way. And then she talks about the word shempa, which is on page 7 in the book, shempa. And that's a Tibetan book, a Tibetan word that means attachment. But she talks about it, and then she wrote a whole book about Shempa, too, if you want to go into it more. It's about being hooked, where we start to tighten and close down, and we try to find relief in any way we can. So this relief, this search for relief, can take many forms. And this is your contemplation. What's my escape hatch? It could be overeating, or it could be alcohol, drugs, or, well, even simpler than that, over-exercise. It could be anything, really. What is the way that we take to escape from this feeling of basic groundlessness? This is her message here, that we feel this groundlessness in our life and we look for an outlet. That's the, we head for the gate, basically. We head for the gate. So her message is, feel it. This is the first step. Feel it. And she mentions this woman, I didn't put her name down, Bolte Taylor,
oh,
I think her name.
Oh, it's a wonderful book.
Yes.
Jill Bolte Taylor.
Jill Bolte Taylor.
Oh, and she has videos, too.
Uh-huh.
TED Talk. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is her book called?
My Stroke of Insight. And so she was
11?
Yeah, she was a young woman, like in her 30s, who was, I think, a neuroscientist.
Yes, a neuroscientist.
And as she was having a stroke, she realized what was happening.
Yes.
And it was taking the language part of her brain, and she was trying to, like, process how to let somebody know. Like, she was aware and awake,
wow,
but how she could communicate to someone that she needed help.
Yeah.
She has this incredible story about it, but also that she had a period while she was recovering where that the language part of her brain wasn't working.
Yes.
And how just everything was so different.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're totally here now because you can't, like, make up a story about it because you
right
can't have language about it.
Right. And so because that of that stroke, she had a lot of insight into the way the emotions arise and the dissolve of that, right? And she said that she talked about, I'll read that sentence on page 11. In my stroke of insight, the brain scientist Jill Bolte Taylor's book about her recovery from a massive stroke, she explains the psychological mechanism, physiological mechanism behind emotion. An emotion like anger that's an automatic response lasts just 90 seconds from the moment it's triggered until it runs its course. 1.5 minutes, that's all. Okay, we're going to have to keep track, you know, just like when you're really irritated or you, you know, whatever. When it lasts any longer, which it usually does, it's because we've chosen to rekindle it. Mm-hmm. That's quite a piece of information. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking for here is the path to liberation. This is what it's about. And we're drilling down now really into how do we do it? It's, yes, we sit on the cushion and we meditate. What's the point of that? To have more gaps, to see what our mind does, to see the thoughts that come up. And occasionally, maybe there's a slight break in that, and we might see some level of spaciousness there. But the point is that we really need to work with the moment those emotions arise. And if it's only 90 seconds, it's phenomenal to think of that, because you could be angry at someone for your whole life, you know, especially you go to a family reunion, which I did this summer, and we had the Trumpers, and my sister calls them the Trumpeters, and then the other ones. And I think this is probably happening in a lot of families at this time, where there's this big divided space, you know, between people that used to get together and have a lot of fun, and all of a sudden. So here we're talking about what is this arisal of energy and what do you do? Okay? So we're actually getting information about what to do, but I don't think it's so easy to always follow it. But that's why it's practice. The understatement of the year.
That's why she wrote the book. I mean, we're meditating to have gaps. But we also want to sit with the energy, too, if it's... But we don't want to let it last. We don't want to feed it.
We don't want to feed it.
We want to acknowledge it.
Acknowledge it, right. So how do we feed it? What do we do when we feed it?
It's
not just pay attention. It's that we have the story that goes with it. So it's not like that person just slammed the car door. It's like they slam the car door every day. It's so irritating. Everybody's there, and it's like it.
Always.
We follow. Yeah.
I think a real good point that she makes quite often in the beginning is that anger in love and joy in fear, they're all equal emotions. One's not good and one isn't bad. And we look at them equally and let them go.
And the
emotion of fear or the emotion of jealousy is just as valid as the emotion of love and the emotion of altruism. Not one is not good and one's not bad. They are what they are. You acknowledge them and let them pass.
And let them pass, right. It's the let them pass. That's the key.
Because you got mad doesn't mean you're a bad person. Everybody gets mad.
You have to be awake to notice them.
Right.
If you let your fear go, then it was just another emotion.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's very hard to kind of be like that when it's not a comfortable emotion.
Right.
You know. I mean, if it's joy, it's a lot easier to take that than fear.
But many times I've heard that your enemies are your best teachers. Because they bring out, you can feel horrible things about them, and if you can let that go.
Yes.
For me, when I feel there's a difference in the body of when the shrimp pipe is hooked and the amygdala has short-circuited, and I'm in it, and I am that feeling, as opposed to what Shinzen Young talks about, whereas I'm a container for the feeling. and that the experience for each is very, very different from a physical and neurological perspective. So once the shempa and my amygdala shuts off, like I'm in it, I am that emotion, I am the anger, there's no higher, there's no top of the mountain. I'm at the base, and it's all just, I'm angry.
You're caught.
Exactly. Whereas there are times when the anger is there, and it's no less intense, but I have been able to pull back just enough up the mountain and be the container for the feeling and allow it in the body to flow and be that wave and complete and not behave out of it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Isn't it amazing that it's only 90 seconds?
90 seconds. Well, then that points to what are we doing after the 90 seconds, if that's really true.
Well, because we do it in the first 10 seconds.
Right.
And we, hopefully we didn't.
Start the story.
But by then, we're going for the ice cream, or by then, you know, whatever it is, there's sort of, I can't take this. Like, there's something. And then, what the instruction is, to acknowledge, this is on page 13, and again, these instructions are going to be important as you work with this. Acknowledge the feeling, give it your full, compassionate, even welcoming attention, and even if it's only for a few seconds, drop the storyline about the feeling. This allows you to have a direct experience of it, free of interpretation. Don't fuel it with concepts or opinions about whether it's good or bad. Just be present with the sensation. Where is it located in your body? Does it remain the same for very long? Does it shift and change? So it's being willing to hold that spot. Yes, did you have more?
Well, just that this holds true for positive and negative emotions.
Yeah.
Equally. People will say, oh, that's just, we only do that for bad emotions. But you also do it about good emotions too, because one of the things that make us yawn, you know, is that we, things that we love, we're so upset we're going to lose them, and that's just as destructive as, oh, I'm so mad at somebody and I'm going to crush them.
So how is it you don't become just flat and sort of unemotional altogether? How is this practice actually going to help me be more alive in the world? That sounds like I'm just going to be kind of dead, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm tricking you.
Well, there's a softness. I mean, if we're cultivating compassion for the very things that we are trying to avoid within ourselves, that maybe through the practice of softening to the suffering, that therefore we are more porous and more available for other people.
That it's sort of like, I think I heard, like, well, why should we let go of an emotion of love? Like, if that arises, why shouldn't we feed it? You know? So, because are we going to make ourselves dead? But you're not saying
that. No, I was being facetious when I said that.
I mean, if you love causes as much samsara as hatred, it makes a lot of people cry.
Well, but I think it's the attachment kind of
thing. Right. Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, I love you so much and you can't ever go away from me.
Right.
Oh, well, that's not really love anyway.
Okay. Right. I mean, love is a big word. I mean, you could take it at any one point on the spectrum, as just we said. It could be attachment and clinging, or it could be vast and open, and so open that you're actually able to receive and be in situations that are very difficult to be in, because you actually are open enough to work with it. So,
also, I think you still have the emotions. It's just the storyline behind it that you let go of. So, it's helpful.
Yes.
And I think you also come from a place of knowing how hard it is to let go of that, to see other people who are like holding a grudge against you, and you're like, oh, yeah, well, like, I have done that a lot. And you can even say to someone, I know that you're still feeling angry because of what I did and these other things. Can we, you know, even say, can we start afresh? Because I was angry at you for 2 years also.
The way it's, working it through.
Or, the question, speaking of that particular issue, it depends on, there may be people, if their age, or station in life, is that they may need to be angry at you, me, whatever, and there's nothing I can do about it, and that I have to be okay with that.
Right. That too.
You can't always fix it.
No.
What?
That brings us to the seeds in life without the storyline. I love this. Yes.
I just think that what Shlomi said is important too, because I know Kama talks about we don't want to get rid of emotions.
Right.
It's not about that.
No.
No.
It's about, as you said, the storyline. We don't want to repress.
No.
And I know it took me a while to kind of figure that out.
Because it's really, you're really in the middle. You're, as she says, you're in the boat in the middle of the lake and it's sinking as a whole. Well, that sounds very appealing. But but it's really, you don't repress and you don't act out. So where does that leave you? Vibrating,
waiting. Listening, waiting.
Feeling. She's saying feel it in your body. Feel, where do you feel it?
Let me hear.
Is it also accepting that that the emotions are going to change, they're going to shift? I mean, if this 90-second thing, you can feel intense love, and then it might switch to irritation, or it may just sort of, modulate a little bit, and then there's some other feeling.
You intensely love somebody, and the next day they leave you.
Yeah, that's right.
What do you do with all that?
Why? Isn't it kind of just putting it into perspective, into the proper perspective, and when you can recognize it and visualize it, you can do that? Because otherwise, intense love can lead to intense jealousy, and so being able to recognize that, and I think then it's okay to feel, as long as you understand why you're feeling and what it's about and are able to adequately address it. And that might mean with your anger, letting it pass, because there's no good is going to come from it. With your love, making sure that you're only focusing on the good components that are useful, that can actually put to something productive.
Well, can we actually do that?
I was thinking it's actually hard to manage it that way.
Yeah. I mean, how do you, if you love somebody, how do you go, I love that person, I don't really love the color of his hair. But, is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
At that point, really?
The point I'm making is, let's say, somebody that you love is going to go out and do something else with somebody else and leave you alone. And yeah, that might make you upset in the moment. And just kind of saying, I'm feeling upset because of my attachment. I'm going to let it go. She has every right to go and do what he or she wants. And, just putting it into perspective, being able to analyze it in the moment.
I'm not that involved, I'll just be honest.
I don't think anybody, I'm not saying that's what I do.
It's hard for me to pick it apart when I'm in it and feeling it.
It's not that she has a right, it's that this is what...
This is what is.
Right, and I don't think your anger is a bad thing. You had your anger.
Feeling uncomfortable feels uncomfortable.
Yeah.
There's no way around it.
Yeah.
And learning how to hang out feeling uncomfortable is really uncomfortable. It's hard. But somehow it doesn't kill us. And there's some kind of... dare I say, kind of a wisdom that starts to show up a little bit. And the next thing happens. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. To me, the point is, don't be buffeted by your emotions. Feel them, but don't let them rule you. You can feel, you acknowledge what comes up. It's natural. We're human. We feel these things. But, don't let them knock you off your feet. And
And it's, everything is, you know, 1 minute you're happy, and the next minute you're sad, and that's the sponginess of the ground we live on. And one of the sayings, you've got to hold a center and kind of just don't be totally buffeted by these emotions, because the ground is very unstable and things change from 1 minute to the next. And if you're always clinging to these emotions, they're just whipping you around all the time, and you never find peace from that.
But sometimes we can't help that, and yeah, we do feel angry, and we do get stuck, and we do get hooked. But then what? It's really a path of awakening. Mm-hmm. It's not like today I'm here, and then the next day, you know, everything's great. You know, there's a path of awakening. So, and there could be big upsets. You could be married for 20 years and you've got a long history with someone and they walk out on you. I mean, you're going to be pretty upset. You know, your whole world's falling apart. But the point is then you contact basically the gap there, that hole and the groundlessness. This is like being willing to feel the groundlessness of really almost every experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you sit down to meditate, you have to have a lot of courage to experience the groundlessness, the irritation of sitting there. If you're in a retreat, you can't get up and leave, or you feel stupid if you do. And, you know, you just sort of, it's really, that's part of going through the process of really working with being willing to be with it. And I think fundamentally, isn't that what we're talking about here? Being willing to be with the feeling, being willing to allow things to arise and not to act and, you know, to have a reaction all the time, but to really be with it.
I think the interesting point you brought up about the physicality of emotion, I mean, we can all intellectualize what we're feeling, but when it starts being embedded in your body, personally for me, that's when I find myself really, really reaching for some kind of stability, because it's sort of like your biological, biochemical systems are shooting off like crazy. And so it's very interesting at that point, how do you stay hanging out, you know? That
groundlessness.
Yeah.
And she says here on page 17, the more you practice not escaping into the fantasy world of your thoughts, so this is the chapter on life without a storyline, the more you practice not escaping into the fantasy world of your thoughts and instead contacting the felt sense of groundlessness, the more accustomed you'll become to experiencing emotions as simply sensations, free of concept, free of storyline, free of fixed ideas of bad and good. You could almost read every sentence in here like
so
that.
So when she says simply sensation, that's what Erica's talking about, right? It's feeling it in your body, and, you know, where is that love? Is it in your cheek? Is it in your heart? Is it in your knee? And when you feel the anger, I mean, that's easier to think about because, you know, you feel it in your gut. You know,
you start to have some sensation of, because you meditate and you work with your mind and you realize you don't buy into every thought and travel down that road, you start to cut the thoughts, you start to allow yourself to open in a different way. You start during the day, I think, to actually contact those little flickers of emotion. And this happened to me the other day, that it got cool, right? And all of a sudden, it got cooler, and it was cloudy, and I thought, oh my God, winter's coming again. And right away, I got instantly depressed. It felt dark. The whole thing felt dark. Now I'm going to be locked up in the house because I won't be able to take hikes all day long or whatever. And that was the story. The story started cranking. And I could feel, I almost called you. I was like, oh no, this is really bad.
And I started to feel depressed, and I really could separate it out, and I could see the arising, and I could see where it was going, and probably I did something to be busy, and that took me out of it, right? My usual.
Yes, I had the same experience, but I was elated. The humidity's gone. I can breathe again. I'm not sweating anymore. Fall is here, my favorite time of year. And that is how, you know, the same event can evoke totally different.
Beautiful.
And the brain is valid, and I'm right, and you're wrong. That's this.
Right. Well, I feel that too, but at that moment,
I was so happy.
Oh, I want summer to go on. I know it's been hot, but, you know, there you go. Judgment, storyline, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I think this is extremely rich material because it's very personal. And everyone will have different experiences and different ways of seeing it. And I feel like this is going to be quite a lively module to go through together. It's a journey, actually, to share this together. I think you could read this book yourself and get a lot out of it, but I feel there's so much more that we get by sharing our experiences, and we spark each other in terms of our understanding. So as we come to the end, which is almost 9 o'clock, the final instruction on page 21 of the second chapter, Life Without the Storyline, is the most simple and direct. Be fully present, feel your heart, and engage the next moment without an agenda. So without an agenda. And that is ultimate openness, the real open space. I don't know, uncertainty, okay, I'm just here, see what arises, and don't have it all worked out. We try to work it all out. I mean, I do. I mean, I have so many lists, I can't even find them. And I feel very comfortable. I feel very comforted. I get these pads of paper that are sort of a little bit like this. Then I have piles of them, you know, but everyone has a list on it. So it's sort of like very comforting to see those lists. And then if wherever I get depressed, I can pick up one of the lists. But I think we all have our pattern, whatever it is, that fills in the blanks. And we're trying not to fill in the blanks. Let's not fill in the blanks. Let's let the blanks be open. And that's what we're being taught here. Let's be open to space. And actually, that's what being alive is. If you're always knowing what's happening, you're solidifying your world to such a degree that nothing's alive anymore. You're in a dead place. And it takes courage to live a life where there's uncertainty and change. The change is happening.
Well, you are living a life where there's uncertainty and change. It takes courage to stop struggling.
Stop struggling. Yay!
I'm trying to make it different.
Right. Oh, that's perfect. So, Will, yes.
So, based on other classes we've had, I just wanted to make a point that the being fully present and not having a storyline and all that doesn't mean that you don't react in the moment. Like if you put your hand in boiling water,
right,
by accident you see, oh, it's in boiling water, you're not just going to say, oh, I'm going to feel it, not a storyline. You react. So
that's right.
I think that's important to...
No zombies on this part,
this
right?
Because it wasn't clear. It wasn't clear from... I guess being present in the moment then informs you as to how you really react.
Right. So if your kid is stepping off the curb and they're going to be hit by a bus, you don't go... Let's see. No! Right away you grab them. You're going to react appropriately.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, any final comments before we close, or thoughts? Great. Well, next week is Joseph, which is a person I enjoy hearing from all the time. I think he's a wonderful teacher. And he's going to actually launch us into the chapter 3, 4, and 5, which is the middle part, but it's the first commitment,
committing to not cause harm. So that's the reading for next time. And you can, you know, we're going to spend three classes on this. So you know, work with it the best you can. And you'll see that, let's see, there's, I think, the meditation instruction. That's chapter four. And Pema, we've been taught, all the teachers in this group have been taught in this exact same tradition, Tibetan Buddhist meditation practice, through our teacher Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And the instructions we give are exactly like in chapter four. So if you want to review meditation instruction, it's right here. It's very helpful. And she has it all laid out. Yes.
I just wanted to say I misunderstood. The guided meditation is not going to be next week.
No.
As I mentioned, it'll be the following one, right?
Right. Next week is Joseph doing this chapter. He's going to launch us into the first commitment. And then the week following will be the meditation, the introduction to meditation, which is for everyone, and it's very helpful. And if you've been here a long time, you can help welcome people to a group. We may have students from Brandeis, and I contacted the professor of the comparative religion department because they've been sending students. She's the teacher that sends them. I found her. And she said, yeah, definitely, I will tell people. So we'll be receiving guests. So, you know, they'll be
party clothes.
Wear your party clothes. Well, whatever.
Wear this.
Be welcoming.
Be welcoming.
Be welcoming.